Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, promise in a new COVID-19 vaccine is tempered by the huge spike of cases. What lessons will nations learn from the virus response, and when can we expect to control the pandemic? Then, what does it mean to decolonize arms control? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The COVID-19 pandemic has reached a new high in infections across the U.S., across Europe, and around the world, in particular as the weather is turning colder. But good news is on the horizon, with the development of at least one and likely multiple vaccines. But how quickly will the vaccines be distributed? What principles will guide their distribution? And how will the pandemic change public health discourses in the U.S. and around the world? Our panel today is Mark Peterson, Professor of Public Policy, Political Science, and Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's working on a manuscript entitled Hardball Politics, Hobbled Policy, Context, Choices, and Consequences in U.S. Health Reform. Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She is the author of numerous articles, including the Manila Declaration on Migration and Health, Commentary of the Association of Pacific Rim Universities Global Health Program. I'll ask the first question of Mark Peterson. Right now, we're in a stage where cases are spiking dramatically across the United States. Congress seems to be deadlocked in any sort of a response to these increased cases, but we have this promise of a vaccine. So I guess the first question is, how likely is it that there'll be some sort of an agreement, some sort of a public policy that can manage this growing caseload in a way where the country can move forward with public health in addressing this crisis?
Well, Doug, there are many dimensions to your question there. Some have to do with just surviving economically, and that's really where the Congress has been logjammed in ways that are very disconcerting. There simply ought to be a very significant piece of legislation that ensures that individuals don't fall through the cracks and small businesses don't get destroyed as we go forward. And we know the Earlier CARES Act had worked, and more needs to be done in that direction, but it seems every day to look worse and worse. Then you've got the issue of certainly in this terrible midst of this rising number count for the pandemic, happening in a period in which we've never been so divided as a country, going at least in the last 100 years. And so trying to maneuver through that context when people become so distrustful of either side and any of the players involved has made it very problematic. And frankly, the president has failed in leadership on that issue. And then you've got the vaccine, one of the elements from which the president actually did contribute in a positive way by helping, at least helping to facilitate the rapid development of these vaccines, but further politicized that issue as well. So even the vaccine that ought to be a positive for everyone is right now caught up in all the distrust. But then you've got the fundamental managerial and production problem of how do you develop enough of the vaccine? How do you distribute it around the country? How do you prioritize among different population groups to get the vaccine, knowing that it's going to be a rollout that goes sometime between later this month and probably well towards the end of the summer of 2021? And that's going to be a major challenge, but I think there is the scientific achievement here is so remarkable. And the capacity to address this coronavirus as rapidly as the community has with developing the vaccine ought to put some energy behind all this. One of the real problems, though, is that we really don't know what's happening in the background. The incoming Biden-Harris administration, for instance, is not getting the information for what exactly has been planned to move from production to distribution to actual, as Biden put it, shots in the arm. And that we're just going to have to see how that plays out as we finally get into the full transition and the inauguration.
Now, Heather Whipfley, the U.S. has been criticized for at least a lack of coordination, although commended and also with international partners at the development of this vaccine. Is the U.S. fairly atypical with the challenges it's faced in trying to develop an effective public policy in dealing with these outbreaks? Or are these issues that we're seeing in a lot of countries around the world?
Well, all countries around the world are right now having to deal with the large question about how are they going to get the vaccine? How are they going to deliver that vaccine to their population? Are they going to prioritize? And all of, do they have the infrastructure? Every country on the planet right now is dealing with these questions. Is the United States an outlier? I think the clear answer to that is yes. From the standpoint of a high-income Western democracy, it's definitely an outlier in that it has not actively participated in the development of the international governance system that's kind of arising around the creation, the allocation, the collection, and then the allocation of COVID vaccines to lower income countries in particular. So the WHO has launched, for example, the COVAX program, which is an initiative, again, to manufacture and buy up vaccine ahead of time so that they can distribute it to very vulnerable, low income populations around the world. And the United States is not participating in that initiative. So the absence of the United States at the global level within a number of these international initiatives to ensure that we follow a human rights and equitable, justice-driven approach to distribution of the COVID vaccine is definitely not taking place.
Yes, and Mark Peterson, one of the things that strikes me is that one of the greatest criticisms of the Trump administration in dealing with the vaccine is that they didn't secure as many doses from Pfizer, for example, mm-hmm. that they possibly could have. And the president's response to that was to propose an executive order, the suggestion being it wouldn't necessarily have that much teeth, but at least an executive order that says that the U.S. wants to make sure to have as many doses for the U.S. Without regard to international distribution. Is that really, you know, portending to the notion, as Heather pointed out, that the U.S. really has terribly little interest in the international impact and really just the interest in the impact here in this country?
Well, what you're seeing is the president, even in the case of a pandemic and vaccines, go to America first. The problem is, from the American first perspective even, is the executive order means nothing. It's not going to have any impact whatsoever. The real question is, when an opportunity was presented by Pfizer to buy a much larger supply to ensure that would be available in this country, why didn't the administration do that? The cynical answer is because Pfizer had not participated in Operation Warp Speed. And as you know, the president tends to favor those who go with his point of view and oppose those who don't. And another unfortunate politicalization of this process. But in the end, the other thing that's complicated here, and this is not a burden on, this is not the charge of the administration, but one of the problems is we've got a number of favorable returns on a number of different approaches to vaccines. Pfizer happened to come in first with an extraordinarily effective vaccine, but it's also a complicated one. It requires two shots spread out, I believe, a month in between, and it needs to be in a deep freeze for storage. So imagine what the transportation and storage problems are with that. And in the meantime, there may be not too much later from now other vaccines that are much easier to handle. And so that's going to be a complicated machination as to how you orchestrate all that. But again, none of that should be affected by politics or partisanship or the kind of polarization we have in the country. And unfortunately, President Trump and his administration have made it all the more complicated by sowing the distrust that people have towards all of these products right now.
And Heather, I know that you've done quite a bit of work in places like East Africa. Is the Pfizer vaccine even viable in places like Uganda, where the technology that would be required in order to store it and prepare it for use, it may very well be beyond beyond the national capacity?
the short answer is no. It's not really a viable vaccine. It's not the vaccine that the world is generally looking to distribute to the region. There's other vaccines that are under, you know, testing, that are close to the finish line, that'll be much more viable, don't have to be deeply refrigerated or frozen, and could be more easily distributed worldwide. I think just to note, though, about this idea, you know, that Trump didn't buy enough or that we didn't buy enough, it really points to this idea that there is this race going on to purchase vaccine and that we are in a phase of vaccine nationalism where everyone's trying to buy as much and ensure that their population will get it first. And so it's just an awkward, strange position for Americans to be in, to be told, nope, somebody else got there first and bought it first. But this is a situation in which many other countries around the world, especially low and middle income countries, are very familiar with having to wait for others to get it before they are given a chance to purchase. And so, and those are the type of issues that the Global Forum is, you know, all these different types of global initiatives are trying to address to make sure that just the rich aren't able to buy up all the supply and leaving low and middle income countries waiting for potentially years before they get access to even enough to vaccinate their most vulnerable segments of society.
Now, Mark, one of the issues that's concerned me is the optimism around the vaccine really can undermine what is really a challenging time that we're in right now with the increase in cases and a seeming partisan divide on even simple preventative measures like wearing face masks. How can we bridge that gap to where we're not necessarily going to see this massive spike, largely as a result of personal behavior in the U.S. that's excused by, oh, but a vaccine is just around the corner, so we don't need to worry about that?
Well, I think there are two things. One is it's become pretty clear that the slippage over Thanksgiving has led to a significant costs in the disease spreading and the deaths that are now emerging. It's a lagging indicator, and that indicator is now looking pretty darn ugly. And the other thing about it is it spread across the country. Even the states that thought they were completely removed, or parts of states thought they were removed from the pandemic. Put those two together, and that might have more powerful messaging going into the Christmas holidays, that people realize this is not something that can be ignored, and maybe there'll be more behavioral response in a favorable way to some of these interventions and simple things like social distancing and mask wearing. Now, the other thing is that Joe Biden has tried to say coming in, first of all, he doesn't have authority to tell people to wear masks except in federal institutions and so on. But his plea is going to be 100 days, effectively. Give mask wearing and social distancing 100 days. We know this is hard. We know it can't go on forever. But that will be the bridge between where we are now in a very desperate situation to the vaccine. And maybe making it seem like something that is not infinite, that is bounded by a reasonable period of time, and that there is this prize at the end, may be enough to help mitigate some of the behavior that otherwise would be very problematic.
I might just add to that really quickly that this vaccine that we have, it's not the silver bullet, for multiple reasons. I mean, one is that vaccines don't save lives, right? The vaccine programs do. The program to actually get it out to people. And right there, we have a challenge still in thinking of how we're going to get it out to the people who need it. Another interesting aspect of this vaccine is that it doesn't stop infection. It stops symptomatic, like kind of response, right? So you don't get sick, but you still get infected. So we're still gonna have asymptomatic potential spread, which makes the need for mask wearing and social distancing and all of these public health priorities need to continue as that vaccine is rolling out. We can't just have vaccines start and everyone kind of returns to normal. And that messaging on the case, on the side of public health, is going to be very challenging to kind of continue to remind people that even if they've been vaccinated, they need to continue to mask for others. And we've had a really hard struggle so far in this outbreak, convincing people that they really need to act in the interest of their neighbor and the country and in the world and not just for themselves. So hopefully as the vaccine rolls out, we'll be more effective in communicating the need for these actions.
And I don't want to add more darkness to that story, but the other thing is we don't even know how long the vaccine will be effective. Will it be a one-time thing, or will it be something where over the years we're going to have to keep coming back and getting vaccinated again? So there's still things that we don't know. It's why we go back to it being a novel coronavirus. It's a lot of education still has to go on within the scientific community before we know how people in the population need to behave.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing how will the pandemic change public health discourses in the U.S. and around the world? But how quickly will the vaccines be distributed? What principles will guide their distribution? Now, Heather, I know a lot of the concerns, particularly international concerns, can be traced to the current American leadership. And there's been some promise that, you know, with the inauguration of the president-elect, that a Biden administration would be more international in their approach. I mean, one specific issue is going to be the expectation that the U.S. would rejoin the World Health Organization, you know, and would be at least open to more international cooperation, international coordination. How much faith do you have in a new administration bringing about better outcomes? Or are these issues really much more systematic, much more structural than just who happens to be in the White House?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that there's no question that a Biden administration will be more multilateral in the sense that they're definitely going to, you know, recommit to WHO, maybe even increase our commitments and join that international like kind of community in endorsing and joining these resolutions. And not just at WHO, but across the board in a number of multilateral institutions. But many of the issues that are being addressed in these forums really deal with large economic approaches and interests. Things like the development of the WHO's CTAP, this is this patent pool for COVID vaccines, where they're encouraging pharmaceutical companies to waive their patent rights during the pandemic and to, you know, really join this solidarity movement and be, you know, collaborative with generic drug manufacturing and really increase access and decrease prices as fast as possible. In the past, regardless of the administration in the United States has never been a big supporter of that type of approach. They've definitely defended pharmaceutical corporate interests. I don't see that changing under our current administration specifically. I don't see us taking that leadership in a very dramatic new direction in the way that many people, I think, would hope, at least internationally, towards more of a justice human rights framework for access to the vaccine.
Now, Mark, at the beginning, you had kind of separated out what's the economic question versus what some of the public health issues are. And that's valuable in conceptualizing it, but they really are tied to one another. The difficulty of some of the stay-at-home orders, some of the lockdown provisions that places like, for instance, Los Angeles County, where we all are trying to implement. What makes that so difficult is the lack of financial assistance for those who would be affected by those decisions. Do you think that the spikes in cases and the clear impact of the Thanksgiving holiday is going to break that deadlock? And will that economic incentive be enough to where we can actually start to stem the increase in these cases? Or are we going to just kind of have to ride this out and realize that we're going to have a bit of a disaster before things get better?
Well, so much depends on whether or not the federal government and the state government are able to provide resources to help individuals and businesses, renters and mortgage payers, make their way through this. And one of the fundamental problems, of course, is even if there weren't any version of a stay-at-home policy or a lockdown, the disease would take care of that. If it spread even more wildly, people aren't going to go to restaurants. They're not going to do the things that these businesses need people to do. So there really is a very integrated relationship, as you pointed out, Doug, and they can't be separated, but they can be separated in the sense of there are two different tracks of public policy, which is to provide the resources to allow it for people to make it through without financial disaster, while at the same time supporting the public health provisions and the vaccination process to make it possible to get to a point where we can get a little more flexibility economically. But it's pure fantasy for people to think, oh, if we just let this go, then everyone will flow to restaurants and those businesses will be fine. It just won't be the case. And so there really has to, one has to strike a very good balance. But part of the other thing too, and here's where the education the learning process of science becomes so important, is when this all really started to unfold in the spring, the response was to just try to close things down with a hammer, if you will. Well, now we know a lot more. We know more about how to really mitigate risks. We know how to give people the tools to think about their own risks within a particular environment, so they don't have to just hover enclosed in their homes. But there are certain things they can do with a fairly modest degree of risk or low risk, other things more risky. We know that the youngest children apparently are much less prone to get infected and to carry that infection on others, so we can keep daycare and elementary schools open in ways that we didn't know we could do back in the spring. We need to be much more adept now at targeting what we do and altering the kinds of behavior that are most risky and allowing more to go on that's less risky, so that in fact, one, you get the opportunity for economic capacity, but two, you also instill or you create greater trust in people with their sense that decision makers are really making informed, thoughtful decisions that are not simply cavalier and shutting down the entire economy.
So, Heather, I teach a course in international relations. We cover the World Health Organization. It seemed like one of the criticisms of any piece that I had assigned was that the World Health Organization was limited by the Westphalian system, was limited by this notion of national sovereignty. And in particular, this coronavirus has demonstrated the globalized world and the need for international responses, because obviously national borders do terribly little towards stopping the spread of this virus. What's the likelihood that the World Health Organization will be strengthened and there'll at least be some degree of challenge of national sovereignty as a result of this virus, in particular because you've spoken of vaccine nationalism, which suggests the opposite is likely to happen?
I really don't have a secure answer to that, or whatever I say, it probably will be the opposite. But I have to say, thinking back to the SARS outbreak, which was really Mother Nature's warning shot across the bow to the whole world about what was coming. And after SARS, the member states of the World Health Organization did come together, did revise the WHO's pandemic response strategy, did give it more power to respond. And in many cases, those alterations have helped in this current outbreak. But the bottom line is that many of the commitments that member states made on paper in terms of power to WHO have not materialized. And that in the end, once the pandemic was underway, countries became exceptionally isolationist, exceptionally focused on making sure that their population are buying up vaccine in secret, all kinds of things against the initiatives of WHO. For example, WHO did launch this COVAX initiative, which I mentioned already, to support the collection and then distribution of vaccine. There was a very large, very ceremonial launch of this initiative and a call from world leaders for $33 billion to support its implementation. And so far, out of the $33 billion, $5 billion has been raised. I mean, that's a severe shortfall. And so really what we're seeing instead is countries maybe saying that, giving it lip service to cooperation and multilateralism, but in practice, they just have not been carrying through on those promises. And so when I think about the future post-pandemic, I think that there will be lip service paid to WHO. There may be some alterations on paper to WHO's powers in terms of having more access to review national outbreaks in advance or make declarations. But I don't think in practice WHO is going to come out of this pandemic any stronger than it was going in. In fact, I think that we just know now a little bit better than ever about how difficult it is for WHO to take that leadership role.
The one thing that might be, and I'm really speculating now, it might be more favorable as we go into the future. As we have more data and we're learning more about how the coronavirus had spread well before we thought it had. It was in the United States much, much earlier. And we know that now from a lot of the wastewater testing and so on that had been going on. And as you said, like, borders are meaningless in the context of a pandemic like this. And so there's going to be more and more, I think, information coming out about the extent to which we were way behind the curve on this. We didn't even know it was happening. It was already spreading across borders. And the only way to deal with something like that is to have international cooperation. And the WHO is the centerpiece when it comes to pandemics for making that happen. And so maybe if we get past this particular era in American politics, if we get past the way the Trump administration approached this issue, and we do have an administration that is more multilateral, there will be an opportunity to learn from this in ways, and having not taken the lesson of the SARS shot over the bow, now that we took 14 torpedoes right into the center of the vessel, maybe this is an opportunity that we will do better in the future.
So I will leave this with a more optimistic view that we will learn from the failures in dealing with this crisis, in the hope that the next time we have this conversation about a new novel coronavirus, that we simply will have learned from the mistakes of the past and can go forward more positively, though a recognition that that level of optimism certainly would not be reflected with the ways in which the U.S. as well as international actors have dealt with this health crisis to date. So perhaps it is, as I always like to say, hoping against reason that we learn something from this response. We've talked about the COVID-19 pandemic today with Mark Peterson. He's professor of public policy, political science, and law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's working on a manuscript entitled Hardball Politics, Hobbled Policy, Contexts, Choices, and Consequences in U.S. Health Reform. And Heather Whipfley, associate professor of clinical preventative medicine and international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of numerous articles, including the Manila Declaration on Migration and Health. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
When we come back, what does it mean to decolonize arms control discourse? Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Arms control discourses are centered around Western notions of modernity and civilization. With us is Ritu Mater to discuss this idea of colonization of language. Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. How much of the discourse on nuclear proliferation and other arms control is dominated by Western notions, and in particular of civilization clash? What would a decolonization of the discourse on arms control mean for the future of nuclear nonproliferation? We discuss these issues in the concept of the West and the rest in civilization discourses with Ritu Mather. She is an associate professor of political science and geography at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And she's the author of the recently published book, Civilization Discourses and Weapons Control. Welcome, Ritu. First off, can you give a brief description of the argument that you're making in your book?
This book actually is providing a genealogy of the history of arms control and disarmament from the late 19th century to the present. So there are arguments, you know, which are put forward by scholars saying that the history of arms control and disarmament is quite short and that there are slender narratives of arms control. But my book actually is trying to show how this particular representation is incorrect, and therefore there is a need for us to have a larger, longer view of history to understand how this dynamics of West and the rest, the civilizational discourse with its racial underpinnings actually has shaped our current day, the architecture of arms control and disarmament.
Within the book, you make references to civilization clash and concepts of knowledge or kind of epistemological arguments based on notions of civilization and on what you call the West and the rest discourses. In what ways does Western discourse or, you know, colonial discourse color the way that we view issues of arms control, issues of armament?
Actually, the book is not so much interested in looking at different definitions of what we understand as West or what we understand as civilizations. It is more regarding looking at these particular concepts of West as a civilization, as a rhetorical resource, which we draw upon to shape particular policies and practices. So there is a lot of contestation in terms of, yeah, what do we understand by civilization and what is this identity of a Western civilization? So within the book also, there is a little bit of a debate with regard to, like, you know, what is this identity of the West? Is it a racial identity? Is it a geographical identity in that sense? Is there some identity of a heroic West to some extent, or is it a question of a fragmented identity, but that the Western identity is used in a sense to mask the internal differences which might be existing in a sense, to provide a kind of a unified identity vis-a-vis the others in the international sphere. So there are these contestations, but the point of the question is, in a sense, when we talk about the West and the rest, how we place this dynamic, how it was introduced by Samuel Huntington at the end of the Cold War period to for remapping the world order. And so this came across as something, you know, suddenly a kind of tidal wave took place in the field of international relations, and all scholars were thinking about remapping the world order. Can we do it in terms of civilizational discourses? The book actually goes and talks about Huntington's representation, how he put it was West and the rest. But Arnold Toynbee at the end of the Second World War actually had spoken about the world and the rest. And his thoughtfulness behind putting that particular equation as the world and the rest was in a sense about whose voices do we want to represent? And I think that is a very important question for us as scholars in terms of whose voices are we representing, the voices of those who are suffering the most. And Toynbee argues that if you actually look at the history of civilizations for several centuries, you will find that it was the non-Western civilizations who actually suffered from the violence, the colonial violence which took place. And therefore, he says it is the world and the West. But Huntington turns the equation around and says the West, and argues that there's a clash of civilizations in the making. And he says this clash of civilization will take place because of nuclear proliferation. And that because of that, there will be a third, you know, world war possibility taking place. And he talks about the Islamic and Sionic nexus, etc. And so he makes these big, broad claims. But then there is a lot of question with regard to how is it that the field of arms control and disarmament did not question Samuel Huntington more rigorously when he made these particular claims. So that is what this book is trying to, in a sense, push Huntington's argument and say that there is a racial underpinning. There are practices of neo-racism at play. And Huntington's work is basically a classic example of neo-racism at play.
I think there's two things going on with Huntington's book and these concepts. I mean, first of all, sort of broadly, we think of Huntington as reminding us that even though the Cold War has ended, there's still a lot of conflict in the world, and the world's still going to be marked by conflict. And that has had such a profound impact on the notion of, you know, the need for new technological advances in weaponry, the need to maintain a nuclear stockpile because there's always going to be threats. But then secondly is this notion that civilization, rather than, say, international relations, we usually speak of states. You know, that's what's driving conflict. And of course, he was responding to Fukuyama's notion that it was ideology that was driving conflict. But then he reintroduces this notion of civilization. I know he's been criticized for a lack of definitional clarity as what he means by civilization. And in reading your book, I see that with you saying, well, I mean, civilization really is part of a colonial discourse. When I see that word civilization, I immediately think of the colonial discourses of things like the British insistence that their colonies needed to be civilized, for example. Is that what you're referencing as neo-racism? Or is there more to it than what I'm describing?
First of all, in a sense, whenever we talk about the literature on arms control and disarmament, right, we'd often talk about technology. Right? And there's a lot of emphasis on technology, right? And so similarly, when we talk about, oh, now there's going to be a new clash of civilizations and weapons proliferation taking place, how are we going to address this? Now, this again is a limitation in the way we study the field of arms control and disarmament. So first of all, is this overemphasis on technology? And second, this overemphasis on the nation state, right, as a generic actor, as the key actor in international relations, because that is how the discipline has shaped our thinking, right? But I try to problematize these practices because I argue that this is only because what you're doing is when you're creating this generic moniker of the nation state, you are depriving states and societies of their particular characteristics of their personalities. Right? And you are in a sense saying, oh yeah, the West has a specific identity, but all these other actors, all these other states in the system, right, they are more or less the same. And as long as they imitate, they catch up in terms of technology, etc., they catch up with the rest, right? That is all that matters, right? And so this catch-up game, this imitation game, that all these other actors, they have the same attributes, right, under Kenneth Walz's neorealism, in a sense, that all the other actors are the same actors, and you, as long as you understand these basic principles of who's the main actor and what are their specific attributes, you understand the field of arms control and disarmament. But this is precisely the limitation which we are talking about, because if you look at the longer history of arms control and disarmament, it was only during the era of colonialism, right, that with the rise of the Western culture, in a sense, or the Western civilization, that technology, which was often regarded as an attribute of a culture, every culture had its technology, but it was an attribute, it was embedded within a particular culture, right? It was not as if technology basically determined a particular culture. But what we are seeing now is in the field of arms control, instead of understanding technology as an artifact of a particular culture, we are in a sense endowing technology, that as long as we restrain the technology, as long as we have control over the technology, we will be fine. And this is exactly where the problem actually starts happening, because then it is diverting our attention from what are the cultural, the racial, the scientific practices, the engineering practices which actually crafted this practices of arms control and disarmament. And therefore, I argue that instead of working with the existing concepts in the field of arms control with regard to a nation state or with regard to technology, it is important that we understand how the field of arms control and disarmament actually is being mapped in temporal terms, right? Understanding the logic of time and space and in arms control, and developing a conceptual framework which talks about practices of stereotyping, sly civility, and basically mimesis. So instead of working with the concepts which already are given to us and always talking in terms of, oh, this is a particular treaty or this is a particular nation state which has signed this treaty or not signed this treaty, because that limits our horizon, that limits our vision. What is really required to open up the vision is to understand really, in a sense, how did we even come to this particular the space of shifting from civilizations to talking about a generic modern nation state focused only on technology grasping, that's all. So shifting this debate, shifting this architecture is very, very important.
So what would be an example of sort of a way that we've been viewing technology and, say, nuclear technology? Because so much of the discourse about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is about what technology is allowed, what technology is not allowed, what needs to be inspected, et cetera. So I understand that epistemological argument that you're making about the way in which we view technology. But what would be an example of a way to view this differently that could have, you know, kind of a practical implication for the way in which we speak about or conceptualize nuclear proliferation?
The question of technology, in a sense, is who has access to technology. So this question is in terms of the gatekeeping practices of arms control and disarmament. Who is deciding who will have access to technology, who will not have access to technology? And this is where a lot of the power struggle takes place. But the question of the matter is that it is not only we today, because of after 1945, we got focused on nuclear weapons as a technology. But the fact of the matter is that these practices of governmentality, these practices of gatekeeping actually have been carried out since the 19th century. So, for example, if you look at it during the era of colonialism, right? When the shift took place in the weapons market from the mercantilistic market to a laissez-faire market, you know, so weapons became more easily accessible. But then what happened is that when there was a when Europe was engaged in an arms race between different countries, and they had surplus of weapons and obsolete weapons, and so they wanted to sell it and to make profit, and so they sold those weapons to, you know, rulers in Asia, in Africa, etc. But once they started colonizing Asia and Africa, right, it became very important for them to make sure that the weapons do not fall into the hands of the common people, because then that will lead to revolts, right? And so, in a sense, to prevent revolts from taking place within the colonies, that actually, you know, you had arms control agreements like the Brussels Declaration, etc., being signed. So it was not a question of just, oh, who has this technology, but the purpose behind it. Purpose was pacification of the African continent, pacification of you know, the revolt which were taking place in India, in China, and all these different places. So how, in a sense, the control of technology was, hey, we sell these weapons to make profit, but we don't sell cutting-edge technology because then they can use the breech loaders, you know, or the other nuclear weapons, they can use them against us. So what is the political purpose behind the crafting of arms control and disarmament regimes? We need to understand that, I think, much more strongly. And I think if we do that by interrogating the colonial history, we get a better sense of it.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing what a decolonization of the discourse on arms control mean for the future of nuclear nonproliferation. I think of one way that this expresses itself, the way in which the argument you're making about the arms control regimes are set up in order to replicate and maintain the existing power structures within the international order, is the fact that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is defined, the states that are targeted for sanctions, that are targeted for action, are defined by the nuclear states. So the fact that when you think of the NPT today, the two countries that we most think about are Iran and North Korea, both of which, for geostrategic reasons, pose threats or at least challenges, particularly to the United States, but the U.S. as allies, whereas other states that have developed nuclear weapons, Israel, for example, has never really been a target of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Now, the challenge to the NPT at this point, one of the greatest normative challenges, is the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that goes beyond allowing a nuclear club and a non-nuclear club to at least create an ideal of a zero option. And because the ideal is not having nuclear weapons, the enforcement of the nuclear weapons regime would shift from the nuclear states, who, you know, their club is their club and they don't want anybody else to join unless it's approved by them, to let's get rid of all nuclear weapons, where the power would then shift to those countries, in particular those that have the technology but have chosen not to go nuclear. Think of Germany and Japan, et cetera, but any non-nuclear state. Would that be an example then of at least an opening that could partially, the phrase you use is decolonize the language, decolonize the conception of the nuclear proliferation regime?
Doug, I'll take this step by step. Hopefully.
Please, that was a lot there.
That's a lot. It's a lot to unpack over here. So the first question is, how do we decolonize the field of arms control and disarmament? There are already debates taking place within IR with regard to decolonizing IR, decolonizing security studies. Now, when we are unpacking, we are decolonizing, we're talking about modernity, we are talking about ethnocentrism, we're talking about universalism, these different concepts which are associated with it. But within the small field of arms control and disarmament, we don't hear any voices debating modernity, debating universalism in the sense the ideal, which you mentioned, of disarmament, right? So if the ideal is the disarmament, which is a universal ideal, then how is it that we cannot question the practices of, you know, of modernity or ethnocentrism within arms control and disarmament, right? Second thing is that when we want to decolonize, another thing is that how are we going to undertake this decolonization? Because often we say, we cannot trust Iranians, we cannot trust North Koreans, they are corrupt, etc., right? So we spatialize the problem. We say the problem is there. Right now, there's plenty of literature to say, okay, you know, which country is cheating and which country is hedging, blah blah blah. There's plenty of literature out there. So what I try to do in this book is, instead of looking at it in terms of specific case studies and spatializing the problem, I talk about the temporal understanding of arms control, in a sense, right? And this is important to understand, that there is a kind of a tunnel of time logic existing within the field of arms control, and therefore we always talk in terms of practices of evolutionism. Right. So, for example, we say, arms control, has it made any progress? From NPT, we are moving towards treaty of nuclear, you know, prohibiting nuclear weapons. So has there been some kind of progress? Right. Have we achieved a better sense of justice within the society? Are we moving closer towards our ideal of disarmament? So there is this sense of, how do we map the sense of progress? How do we map the sense of shift which is taking place? Now, it is important to understand that this mapping is actually taking place in a linear time plane, right? So starting from 1945, then you come to 1967, the NPT treaty 1970, and then you're coming to 2020. So this is some kind of a linear mapping which we are taking place, right? We're talking in the language of evolutionism. Now, again, this is very, very problematic because you see, during the era of colonialism, there was again the movement by the Orientalists, in a sense, to say that the Western society, the Western civilization is making an advancement. And the way you can map this advancement, this progress, is by linear mapping of societies. And that is how we have our sense of time, a linear understanding of time. And there was a way of saying other societies, their understanding of time is very cyclical, right? It is repetitive, right? It goes in a cyclical fashion. So nothing new is taking place in those particular societies, right? And so those societies are savage, they are barbaric. So it is very difficult to track any modernity or any kind of progress or development taking place in those societies. And it is because we have, in a sense, put these different societies, different civilizations, right, on different time scales, right? We have a different way of mapping about who's making progress and who's not making progress, right? And so often it is because of these different time scales that we often refer to particular actors, like, for example, you mentioned Iran, North Korea, etc. We refer to them as the figures of alterity or the dirty dogs in arms control and disarmament. Whereas, on the other hand, those who are conforming to our principles, who are conforming to our timeline, in a sense, we refer to them as the noble savage, right? For example, Israel. Right? So how we, in a sense, classify actors using these practices of Orientalism, using this temporal logic in which we put these different actors into play. Now, another thing when you're talking about moving on to this treaty of prohibiting nuclear weapons, in a sense, how did this treaty come into play? It came into play precisely because there was a sense of discontentment within the field of arms control and disarmament. Right? Because many actors who were put into this category of being semi-civilized states, for example, China in the colonial era, etc., or semi-civilized or, you know, barbaric states, etc., and, you know, the global south in that sense, right? This understanding that, oh, they cannot govern themselves, they don't have any understanding of law, they don't have any understanding of rules, they have no conception of time, they have no conception of technology. So how can we, in a sense, give them these weapons? How can we provide them, you know, this thing? And so the custodians and the guarantors of the field of arms control are the Western powers, right? And that is how this distribution of power was justified for a long period of time. And it was precisely because of this revolt, and Hedley Bull recognized it, but he did not empathize with it, right? It was precisely because of this revolt, which has been there for a long period of time, that today you see a treaty on prohibition of nuclear weapons actually has been signed, right? Whether this is a signal towards modernity, towards achieving disarmament, that is a second question we can explore further.
So sort of at the core of a desire to have nuclear weapons is a notion of sort of political advancement. And you're talking about the way in which we've defined modernity, or we've defined even, you haven't used the word, but I'll use the word development, as a tied to the political prestige of having nuclear weapons, of becoming a part of the powerful club. That certainly was the major motivation of a country like, say, India and later Pakistan, wanting to develop nuclear weapons, and other countries doing so. So is the need to try to redefine what we consider to be modern as something other than the possession of nuclear weapons? Is that one of the goals in understanding this?
The thing is that, like, in a sense, when you talk about, you know, what pushed India and Pakistan, right, to acquire nuclear weapons, right? And then there is always this generic logic, right? There's a modern nation state, and if you want to survive in the modern nation system, you have to basically acquire these weapons. And because these weapon systems, the weapons which you possess, they place you in a particular hierarchy in the international system. Every few decades, the technology or weapons technology keeps changing. But the question is that who has at the apex of this particular technology? So there is always this thing of catching up. Were India and Pakistan, in a sense, trying to acquire these weapons? Well, because they were trying to catch up with the West. Other way of looking at it was also because for a long period of time, these countries were also talking about nuclear disarmament. But basically, nobody was paying any heed to India's debates with regard to nuclear disarmament. And so when they started talking about civilizational exceptionalism, when India started talking about in terms of, oh, we are like the US, right? We are both democracies. We both believe in laissez-faire. We both believe in free markets, etc. So there was, in a sense, the shifting of the discourse, right? Talking about American exceptionalism and talking about India's civilizational exceptionalism. That produced some kind of a bridging, in a sense, or partnering between these two different countries. So India, in a sense, what did it do? It tried to, in a sense, re-signify the civilizational metaphor, you know, and was opportunistic enough to use it in its own favor, right? So I think that is what, in a sense, would explain to some extent its behavior. But another thing was also the sense of frustration which came because of the indefinite extension of the NPT. Right? Because what happened with the indefinite extension of the NPT was, you know, the colonial powers, the imperialist powers, there was a sense of their nostalgia of holding on to their power, holding on to their privileges. And the best way of achieving that was, you know, making this treaty an indefinite extension instead of every 5-year renewal. So when countries like India were faced with that particular option, right, that you don't have any way out of it, then it becomes, okay, let's get onto this bandwagon of, you know, civilizational exceptionalism.
And of course, with this indefinite extension of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in the mid-1990s, the record has actually been, I think it's fair to say, it certainly has been worse. There's been a backsliding with respect to even the enforcement of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and this reconsideration of whether or not this is the model for which we should consider the management, the governance of nuclear weapons. It's certainly been called into question, ironically, not just by those who have been targeted, but also by the countries that are seemingly benefiting from it, with countries like, say, the United States, Russia, the unraveling of nuclear arms deals and this promise of development of new nuclear technology. So how much could the unraveling of the existing order open a space for the type of conversation that you're demanding and that the book very eloquently argues is this need for a reconceptualization of the way in which we talk about nuclear weapons?
There is a sense of, you know, that the field of arms control and disarmament is dying. It's a moribund discipline. So how do we, in a sense, revive this field? How do we reconstellate practices of arms control? And this is becoming increasingly difficult because the superpower is walking out of most of the arms control agreements, right? Whether it's the INF treaty, you know, and whether it's the TPNW, it tried to put a lot of obstructions in the negotiation phase, etc. The START treaty, the landmines treaty. So when you have such a disruptive, you know, a hegemon at play, which is so keen on talking about America first and its strategic interests. It is not talking about the rule of law. It is talking about strategic interests. It is talking about the American way of life or the Western way of life and saying that this is the only valuable way. This is the only valuable civilization worth preserving, right? It is under this particular discourse that it becomes a real challenge in terms of how do we reconstellate practices of arms control and disarmament. So three actually options come up. First of all, which came up from the humanitarian actors was disarmament as humanitarian action. So you had the ICBL campaign, you had the cluster munition campaign, and now you have the nuclear weapons prohibition campaigns with the humanitarian initiatives. The second option which came up was, Jack Donnelly talking about human rights as a new standard of civilization, right? So making a distinction between the old classic civilization, which in a sense, he does not problematize about how it provided some kind of a tunnel of time for the other actors to walk through so that they could achieve a particular status of formal equality. And then now you have new standards of civilization which will result in domain expansion of the rule of law system. And so I basically provide a critique of this because when you talk about this human rights system as a new standard of civilization, first of all, the human rights discourse is very, very problematic because it is a discourse which came up when the West had lost its moral superiority at the end of the Second World War with the Holocaust. Second thing is that this discourse is very individualistic in nature, and with practices of surveillance, it can basically crush any kind of dissent, as was seen in the case of nuclear scientists in Western democracies like Oppenheimer, etc. So it is very difficult to actually organize any kind of collective effort of resistance in terms of talking about, you know, the legal practices. Another thing is that the human rights discourse is also being used to compete and undermine the existing discourse on international humanitarian law. And therefore, it is very, very difficult to talk about human rights as new standards of civilization. Also, because when you talk about the discourse, you talk about human agency, right, which is very, very important. But now what is happening is the technology is increasingly shifting towards automation, where the human element also is disappearing. Right. So when we talk about the responsibility, when the weapons are being used, in a sense, who's responsible? Is it the weapon or is it the human agency? And that exactly comes into the case with regard to drone warfare, because somebody might be sitting over here, but then the action is taking place somewhere in Afghanistan or Pakistan. So there are different layers, different hierarchies of authority with here. And so how does this actually play out? So this discourse is extremely complex. Also, the human rights discourse, human rights law is the weakest law under the humanitarian auspices of the law legal system as such. So the US emphasizing human rights as a new system of civilization for regulating warfare, in a sense, is an extremely dangerous, slippery path to go through. The third practice is in terms of civilizational exceptionalism. And you find that with civilizational exceptionalism, particular countries like India or the US, they can stay at the helm of the hierarchy of the arms control, or they can achieve their own upward mobility. But that is not necessarily the case for the multiple actors, you know, more than 190 countries in the international system. So you see all these three different pathways are extremely weak. And so when we talk about, in a sense, remapping the constitutional nuclear order, I think we need to pay more attention to how law is basically being used as some kind of a civilizing therapy, as Angie mentions, basically. So civilizing therapy, in a sense, to pacify, to maintain some kind of a status quo within the particular system.
So your book fundamentally is a clarion call for a wider, more diverse set of voices and a wider and a more diverse set of concepts being brought into our discourses on weapons control and nuclear weapons and weapons control across the board. And in that spirit, your book absolutely contributes to those wider and more diverse voices. The book is called Civilization Discourses in Weapons Control. The author is Ritu Mather, our guest. She is the Associate Professor of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug. Really appreciate this.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.